come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapults to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
The Bible tells us that to everything there is a season, and it sure seems like the season for a lot of the prophesied events of the Bible, end times events, is right now. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest is, been with us before. He's a scholar of Bible prophecy, author of many best-selling books, including Psalm 83, Missing Prophecy Revealed, Nuclear Showdown in Iran, Israelistan, and the new one, which is the topic of our conversation today, The Now Prophecies. It's our honor to welcome Bill Salas back to the program.
Derek, it's great to be back with you. I love being on View from the Bunker. It's a wonderful radio program.
Well, you're very kind. I'm just thankful the Lord's found a way to use my psychological need to express my opinion to the entire world in a positive way. The Now Prophecy is kind of a compelling title because we think of prophecy as something that's going to happen at some point in the future. And when we're looking at the Bible, of course, we're looking at events that were written down, prophesied 2,000 to 3,500 years in the past, maybe in some cases longer. What is it about what you see in the world around us today that led you to write the Now Prophecies?
Well, you know, these prophecies, I've been studying them intently for quite some time. About a third of the Bible is devoted toward Bible prophecy. Some of that has been fulfilled, but a lot of it has not. And a lot of it will happen in the very near future, in my estimation. They're imminent events that are pending right now. The stage is set for them. And so the Now prophecies would be the ones that lack conditions, or there are very minimal preconditions before they could find fulfillment, meaning we need to be prepared for them now. So my goal, Derek, is to try to categorize prophecies. I would like to know what's going to happen possibly in my near future that would affect my family and my grandchildren. Yes, it's important to understand about the book of Revelation, the harlot world religion, the Antichrist, the mark of the beast. It's good to have a good overview of Bible prophecy, but to be honest with you, I'm a pre-trib rapture believer. I'm not so sure that I will be here for those things. So therefore, I want to focus on those, but more importantly, focus on what I believe could actually happen right now. And I think there are things that we need to be thinking about that could happen right now. And I'll give you an example. Noah heard that there was going to be a worldwide flood. And when he heard that, that changed his whole mindset. He got busy building his ark. That was his Now prophecy. Joseph heard there was going to be 7 years of famine. And that got him going to start storing up wheat in the storehouses during the 7 years of plenty that he also knew would precede that. And there's a whole list of these things in the Bible. And for instance, Jeremiah, he started warning the Jews that they would go into 7 years of captivity in the southern kingdom of Babylon, which happened in 586 BC. And at that time, when he was prophesying, he got the people prepared to think about that Now prophecy. So I'm trying to let people know there are certain things we need to know right now that are Now prophecies that we need to be prepared for.
We see things in the headlines almost every single day. The rise of the Islamic State over the last, well, it's actually been longer than the last year and a half, but they just declared the caliphate at the end of June 2014. But the rise of Iran, especially with the assistance of the United States and our Western allies, freeing up money. Iran using some of that money that's been freed up, we just heard in the last week, to offer incentives to Palestinian terrorists to attack Israelis. Just crazy things that appear to be happening for no apparent reason. You've written about the potential for a disaster in Iran. We're also seeing things unfolding in Syria. And there's one prophecy that I think very famous prophecy, the burden of Damascus, Isaiah 17. Are these the kinds of prophecies that you're looking at right now as having a very near-term fulfillment?
Oh, actually, yes, Iran and Syria are on my list of Now prophecies. They're on my watch list of things to look for. Basically, the Now prophecies that I think your listeners should be concerned about would be a disaster in Iran. And these are the things I write about in the book. A disaster in Iran and the destruction of Damascus, a toppling of Jordan, a terrorization of Egypt, a final Arab-Israeli war. I believe that would be Psalm 83. I'm also very concerned about this country, America. I foresee a decline of America as a Now prophecy. actually devote 3 chapters to the book about the decline of America. And then the expansion of Israel. The world's trying to shrink Israel up right now, ask it to give up land for peace, but that is not part of the prophetic plan of God. And then probably one of the big ones I'm on the lookout for is the vanishing of the Christians, i.e. the rapture. So these are just a list of about 9 or so prophecies. There's a few others that could be incorporated in there, but these are the big ones that I believe are going to roll off the parchment and hit the pavement here real soon.
Hmm. And we talked about your Psalm 83 prophecy before, the nearby neighbors of Israel joining a coalition to come against it. That certainly seems plausible based on the headlines that we read. Damascus, I've seen drone overflights, and Damascus, at least the parts that were in the video that I saw, looked like it's been turned into a heap of rubble already. The disappearance, decline of America, that's an interesting one, though, because that is the presence or absence of America in Bible prophecy is a question that scholars here in America have been wrestling with for generations. Where do you see America in Bible prophecy, if anywhere, and what is it that leads you to conclude America is on the decline?
Well, there's inside of the book, I approach this subject from different perspectives. I look at historical and biblical precedent from nations and or empires that have crossed the dangerous biblical boundaries that America has now crossed, and America's crossed them all at this point. And we look at their history, and they've seldom, if ever, digressed back to redeem themselves. And in most all instances, they've usually been destroyed as a result of crossing those dangerous biblical boundaries. I also look at us, where we're at in Bible prophecy. Some people say we're not in Bible prophecy. I tend to disagree. I think we can find ourselves in Ezekiel 38, verse 13, where you have this list of, they appear to be protesters of this major Ezekiel 38 invasion. Mm-hmm. And they have Sheba, Dedan, the merchants of Tarshish, and their young lions, which is where I think we would be. I call this America in Ezekiel 38, where I lay out the biblical and the geopolitical and archaeological reasons why that's probably us. And one of the problems with that is if that's us, the greatest superpower that ever lived, we are sitting on the sidelines protesting a massive invasion led by Russia, which would include Turkey and Iran. And there's a coalition of 9 altogether, predominantly Muslim countries apart from Russia. They're going to come to invade Israel for the plunder and booty that Israel possesses. And so, I'm wondering, what's our position there? Why are we in a mere protesting model, it seems to be, at that point? So I get into that. But mainly I also talk about the different stages that America's gone through, how we, you might recall that over the last several decades, the mantra across a lot of the churches was 2 Chronicles 7:14, which says, if my people who are called by my name would humble themselves and pray and seek my face, that the Lord would hear from heaven, forgive their sins, and heal their land. So a lot of the people who were concerned about the direction America was taking were saying we need to pray for that we might then have a Nineveh moment, when Jonah went to the Assyrian Empire and said, in 40 days, you're going to be destroyed. And the king of Nineveh issued a proclamation, and he and all the Assyrians, got down on their knees and had a national repentance, and their destruction was spared. So the thought would be maybe by praying that prayer and the people of God would turn toward God and repent, that we could bring redemption to this country. But my concern now is that we've gone beyond that, and now we're experiencing a couple other biblical moments like Jeremiah 7:16, which is, for instance, Jeremiah was told at some point to just stop praying for the people of the southern kingdom of Judah. God tells him in that verse, he don't even try to make intercession for the Jews at that point, because the Lord knew in his foreknowledge that they would not have a turnabout. There would not be a repentance. And of course, he then started telling Jeremiah to prepare them for 70 years of Babylonian captivity. And then ultimately where that leads, and this is where I think we're at right now, and I'm very concerned about this, is a Hosea 4:6 moment. And again, I write about all these in the Bible. Hosea 4:6 says, my people perish for lack of knowledge, or my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. And the point being is that The people of God are not getting the important knowledge they need to know about these now prophecies, what's about to happen in their world. They're not getting it on a broad level across the pulpits of America. And so when the judgments and destruction start to happen, not only in the Middle East, but as they work their way across the globe, the people of God will be unprepared for them, and therefore they would be destroyed for the lack of the knowledge. And it's not because, and that for Hosea's time, that was the northern kingdom of Israel. Him and Isaiah and Amos were some of the prophets that were letting people know that the northern kingdom of Israel was going to be destroyed. But the leadership at the time, the religious leadership, was not getting the message out far and wide. And that's the same kind of problem we're having here. So it's not that God is not giving the information. It's just that the churches are not getting the memo out to their parishioners. Mm-hmm. And that's the concern. So when the, you know, when this country gets judged, and many of us believe we're headed for that right now, and maybe even heading for destruction, the people of God are going to be unprepared, caught off guard. And that's what's very troubling to me.
That's one of the things that really strikes me as well, that we as Christians aren't taught prophecy in church for the most part. You know, I was 35 years old before I ever heard prophecy from the pulpit in any of the churches that I'd attended. And, you know, Sharon, she grew up in an independent Baptist church learning prophecy from the time she was like 6-7 years old. But there aren't many of those out there. And there's a new Barna Group study that was just released today and shows just how out of step we Christians are who take the Bible seriously with the rest of our culture. According to Barna, more than half of the agnostic, skeptical, and atheistic people who live around us consider those of us who take the Bible seriously to be extremists. You know, how dare you try to live according to your faith? And sadly, a lot of the clergies try to go along with that. So when you say a now prophecy, I mean, putting a time on the fulfillment of something that's in the Bible is always kind of a dangerous proposition. How do you define the term now in the now prophecies?
Well, Merriam-Webster's dictionary says now is at the present time.
Right.
Currently, this sort of thing. So when I look at prophecies, I look at the ones that have minimal to no conditions, which ones also have some conditions, and which ones still have quite a few conditions. The ones that lack conditions at this point are the ones that we should be thinking about. They're going to happen at some point in time. The question is, will that be in the very near future? So what I do inside the book, and I'm going to answer this question after I give you this little time parenthetical here. What I do inside the book is I try to let people know where we are presently, where mankind is presently on the prophetic timeline. Where are we on God's calendar of events? And we find ourselves in between two monumental events. One of them is in 1948, the rebirth of the nation of Israel. That was a huge, huge event. That was when people needed to start thinking about Bible prophecy. That is when the books, the prophetic books, became unlocked, unsealed for all intents and purposes. Hmm. And then we move the clock forward 68 years to 2016. That's where we're at right now. And we see all this stage setting going on with all these prophecies and stuff. But where we're headed toward is the next marquee event, and that's Ezekiel 38. That is when the Lord has chosen that event. It will be the most massive armed and dangerous Mideast invasion of all time up to that point. And he's going to stop that invasion, that Russian-led invasion of Israel. And when he stops it with an earthquake, fire, hailstone, and brimstone, it'll be clear it was the Lord, not the Israeli Defense Forces, not America. Then he's going to be able to say that he has held, he's made his holy name known in the midst of his people Israel. They shall not profane it anymore, and the nation shall know he's the Lord. That's in Ezekiel 39, verse 7. I trumpet this message in this book, Derek, because that is a monumental, huge event. The Lord is going to let the world know. He's going to silence his critics. He's going to let the world know that Israel is not undisputed or occupied territory. He's going to shoot replacement theology in both feet through this prophecy, which is all Israel-centered. We're heading toward that. And the question is that a now prophecy or next prophecy? And if it's not a now prophecy, what prophecy set the stage to get there? And how far away is that event? Is it another 68 years away, that other bookend prophetic event? So here's in a nutshell, that's not a now prophecy in my estimation. The Lord is about to let the world know he's God. the holy God of the Bible, the one true God, who keeps his covenants with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who sent his son Jesus Christ to die for our sins, which is all part of that Abrahamic covenant. He's about to do that. But Ezekiel 38 has some serious preconditions. It talks about a people, the Jews brought out of the nations of the world in the latter days to dwell in the midst of the land of Israel. And we give check marks to that. That's been going on for the last 68 years.
Mm-hmm.
But it says they will be dwelling securely without walls, bars, nor gates, and they'll be extremely prosperous because Russia's coming for the plunder and the booty. And I contend that Israel's not accomplishing those prerequisite conditions just yet, dwelling securely without walls, bars, nor gates, etc. And I give a whole list in the book as to reasons why that is. And so therefore I call that a next prophecy. It needs the now prophecies to find their fulfillment to eliminate the preconditions that exist in Ezekiel 38. So that brings us now into this gap. 2016, here we are today, a marquee event of Ezekiel 38 coming around the corner, probably not too far away. What are the now prophecies in the middle of this gap here? And I have a whole gap. I have a timeline in the books and that sort of thing. So what could happen now? That's my goal. And that's what I've got that list of things I told you earlier in the program, mm-hmm. that these are big events. They're not going to just confine themselves to the Middle East. End times Bible prophecy is globally impacting. They're the events that the Lord knew would reshape the world from that point forward.
And given that you've talked before about Psalm 83 setting the stage for Ezekiel 38, the Gog-Magog conflict, then Psalm 83 would fall into that category of one of the now prophecies that we're waiting for to set up the next prophecies. Is that do I get that right?
That's one of them, yeah, yeah. Because I call it the final Arab-Israeli war, mm-hmm. slash it's the Psalm 83 prophecy written 3,000 years ago by Asaph. See, in that particular scenario, where you have these 10 belligerents that confederate, not the ones listed in Ezekiel 38, they're entirely different. And
right,
they're the
right.
ones that voted against their being in Israel, you know, as we look at them today, they're modern day equivalents. They came to war against Israel in 48, 67, and 73. They don't recognize Israel's right to exist today. They're the very reason Israel is building walls around every one of its land-bearing borders. Mm-hmm. Israel is the most fenced-in, walled-in, most fortified nation in the world. And they're trying to protect themselves from these enemies around them. And the world's trying to get Israel to give up land to these Palestinians and support the Arab plight. And that's not biblically endorsed, and that's not going to happen. And so, therefore, the way that you're going to bring resolve when diplomacy fails, and it's failing on the Middle East-Palestinian-Israeli conflict, is you have a war. And I believe that's a biblical war, and I believe that's going to be forthcoming. And I don't see a lot of preconditions that stand between 2016 and that event, apart from a couple of fragile peace treaties between Israel and Egypt and Israel and Jordan, who I believe both of those populations are listed in Psalm 83. Now, once you have the Israeli Defense Forces used as the tool in Psalm 83 to win that final Arab-Israeli war, empowered by God, like Gideon was empowered to defeat the Midianites in the mm-hmm. book of Judges, you then could have Israel tearing down that 400-mile wall and all those fences around its borders because they feel much more secure and they can expand territorially, which is also biblically supported. And I talk about the expansion of Israel and that. Now you could have an Israel that's dwelling securely in the midst of the land without walls, bars, nor gates that's very prosperous. And their prosperity could be because, one, they're already finding natural resources there, natural gas
oh, yeah.
finds and oil discoveries. Two, you can have more Jews fleeing, you know, making their way into Israel, bringing their wealth and their ingenuity and their skills. And then three, you're going to have Israel being able to capitalize on increased land possession and spoils of war. And when Israel wins wars, historically, they take land mm-hmm. and spoils of war. They did this with Joshua about 3,500 years ago, King David about 3,000 years ago in modern history, 1967, that war, Six-Day War.
This is an aspect of your analysis that I find really intriguing. I've been doing some study on the Dominion theology, on Dominion theology and the Kingdom Now movement over the last and how it's developed over the last couple of decades. And there is a small subset within that group that believes that at some point God will fulfill the land promise that he made to Abraham. And I guess scholars have argued as to whether or not you could make a case that that was already fulfilled during the time of David or Solomon, but setting that aside, doesn't matter whether it was or not. Apparently, this group believes it hasn't been yet, and that's the key point. How much land do you see in the Bible an indication of how much land Israel is going to come away with?
Well, it's interesting. And on the DVD, by the way, that goes with the book, I actually have an image on there in the presentation where I show how you could have 36 Israels today fit into the Promised Land.
Huh, yeah.
I mean, we don't know the exact measurements. It could be a little more, a little bit less than 36 Israels. Presently, Israel is about 8,000 or 9,000 square miles, about the size of New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
But we're told in how much land they're going to get in several places. One of the probably the most vivid descriptions in Genesis chapter 15, verse 18, where it says that God was going to give to Abraham the land from the river of Egypt, probably the Nile, to the Euphrates, which courses through modern-day Iraq and Syria. So that's almost 36 times as big as what Israel is today. Now, they're going to get all that. They got some of it right now since 1948, and they increased it in 1967. They're going to get all of that when Jesus returns and sets up the Messianic kingdom for 1,000 years, and we're told that in Revelation 20, verse 4. However, I believe they're going to get some of it incrementally like they did in 1967 after they win the Psalm 83 war. Now, what are they going to get after that? Well, I believe they're going to get Jordan, and I show the scriptures in there for that. In fact, I'll just rifle off a few scriptures as I talk about it. Obadiah 1, verses 19 through 20 says they're going to get part of southern Lebanon around where Zarephath is. They're going to get the Judea-Samaria area. They've already kind of got it, but that's the West Bank today. They're going to get the Gaza back. They're going to get parts of southern Jordan. Jeremiah 49, verse 2, and Zephaniah 2, verse 9, pictures Israel taking over northern Jordan and probably central Jordan, so getting all of Jordan at that point. Isaiah 19 and 18, Isaiah 19, verse 18, talks about five cities in the land of Egypt, speaking the language of Canaan, which is Hebrew. I believe that can also possibly happen after Psalm 83. So I'm looking at them getting a fairly significant expansion going. New atlases being drawn in the very near future. You know, the atlases were all redrawn after the Ottoman Empire collapsed in 1917 as the Arab states got their land, and then, of course, Israel in 1948. But I believe they're going to be redrawn yet again in the very near future.
Yeah. And a lot of blame assigned to the Europeans for what's happening in the Middle East today because of the way they drew those borders. And some of that is probably true. We in the West have had our fingers in those pies in the Middle East without real justification for a long, long time. But I suspect that's because looking at this from the standpoint of acknowledging the existence of territorial spirits, I think there's some influence there that are driving humans to do things that would otherwise be considered irrational. And the Islamic State, case in point. Coming back to the United States, because this is – the United States is where I keep all of my stuff. You make an interesting – devote a chapter in the book to Americans and us perishing for lack of prophetic knowledge. What are some of the boundaries, some of the things that we are doing in the United States specifically that will, and correct me if I'm phrasing this incorrectly, but remove God's blessing or protection from us?
Well, okay, let's look at a few historical examples and biblically, and then we'll look at some current examples over the last six decades of, you know, that correlate with this. Sodom and Gomorrah was destroyed for sexual perversion around 2000 BC at the time of Abraham. Idol worship, which in its worst case led to child sacrifice, is what caused the destruction of the northern kingdom of Israel in 722 BC by the Assyrian Empire. Wickedness and moral decadence is what caused the Assyrian Empire to collapse around 612 BC by the Babylonians and the Medes. Anti-Semitism, not blessing Israel, which is part of God's foreign policy in Genesis 12, verse 3. He said, "He'll bless those who bless Abraham, he'll curse those who curse him." And that extrapolates on through Isaac and Jacob, you know, Abraham's lineage, on through to the Jewish people today. And that was around the Pharaoh. Of course, that was an example of that of 3500 BC. Now, what has America done over the last, let's say, past 50 years? Well, in 1962, Engel versus Vital, we removed prayer in public schools. So we don't need you anymore there, God. Mm-hmm. 1963, Abington School District versus Shemp, we took Bible reading out of public schools. Remember, these are back in the days of Donna Reed and, Father Knows Best. And,
yeah.
Maybe even a little bit before your time, but it was around my time when I was growing up. 1973, Roe versus Wade, we legalized abortion.
Right.
Now we're having approximately 1 million abortions per year. You know, we've had over 55, maybe 60 million abortions since that time, which is an abomination to God who, you know, we find out in the book of Jeremiah, he knows us when we're in the womb. I mean, our life is formed and that point. So, 1980, the Stone versus Graham, the Supreme Court said it was unconstitutional to have the Ten Commandments in the public classrooms. And 2003, the Supreme Court decision in Texas, Lawrence versus Texas, which invalidated sodomy laws and ultimately hit 13 other states. 2013, the Supreme Court, United States versus Windsor, struck down the Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA, which basically is biblically supported, which says in Genesis 2:24, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined with his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Well, the Defense of Marriage Act was, you know, one man should be married to one woman. Mm-hmm. And that was struck down, a key provision of that, by the Supreme Court in 2013, which paved the way for the major deal, Obergefell versus Hodges, a Supreme Court case which ruled in favor of same-sex marriages, which is absolutely unbiblical in the Old Testament and also in Romans chapter 1, verse 27. And the present White House administration, when we talk about anti-Semitism, is come out really, they've been the worst administration against Israel in the last several decades. Matter mm-hmm. of fact, a poll was done recently in Israel out of Tel Aviv asking who was the worst American president in the last 30 years. And hands down, Barack Obama got 67% of the vote. A distant second was Jimmy Carter at 17%. Huh. So, you know, we're in a situation right now where we have basically kicked God out of our culture, out of our country. We've crossed every dangerous biblical boundary that we can cross. I know that you and I talked about this before the show here, Derek, that the table talk of the country is maybe the Lord will lift up a political superhero that will – you know, turn this country around. And I think we talked about how Donald Trump seems to be getting all this attention right now. Maybe they're thinking, maybe this is the guy that's going to save everything for us. Maybe he's the last Trump of the Bible, Donald Trump. But I'm just telling people, look, get your eyes on the right superhero, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, amen.
There's a lot of things in play right now. There's now prophecies that are about to find fulfillment. And I ask the listeners, are you ready for them? Do you know what they are? And do you know how to prepare for them emotionally, physically, and spiritually, most of all, spiritually? That's what this book is going to do.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly right. And I won't belabor the point, but I've been saying as the election season has moved on the daily commentary on Skywatch TV that we are not going to elect Jesus into the White House, nor is the next president going to appoint him to the Supreme Court. So we need to focus on the real superhero here. So amen, brother, preach it. Now you referred to the Ezekiel 38, circling back to the Gog Magog conflict, and I've been doing some reading on this too, just because I'm kind of a history nerd and I like little tidbits and bits and pieces. Certain periods of history that really fascinate me. One of those periods of history is going all the way back to the days of Nimrod, the Tower of Babel, and there lo and behold, there's a little known, at least by us here in the West, unless you're Armenian, that the founder of the nation of Armenia, who was named Haik, I believe if I pronounce it correctly, led his people out of Babylon because of the oppression of Nimrod as a king. And Nimrod went forth with an army to try to bring them back or subdue them and was actually killed by this fella up in Armenia. And they traced this Haik's ancestry back to Togarma, one of the sons of, was it Japheth, I believe?
I believe it was.
Yeah, so grandson of Noah. And, of course, Beth Togarma, the house of Togarma, is one of the coalition that will join Magog in the war against Russia. Now, all of that to say this, a couple of weeks ago, Russia and Armenia cemented a defense, like a 20-year-long defense agreement to allow Russia to base air assets and soldiers in Armenia, which is kind of worrying to Turkey because Armenia is on Turkey's eastern border. And, of course, the Russians and the Turks have been fussing with one another if you've been watching the news. Things are moving into place that make Ezekiel 38 seem more plausible now than even just a few years ago. But even with all of that, why do you call the Gog-Magog conflict the marquee event instead of something like, I don't know, the rapture.
Right. Well, that's a very good point. The marquee event is because God has chosen that as the marquee event. That is the event of all the unfulfilled biblical prophecies in the end times, where he says specifically that he will make his name known in the midst of his people Israel. They shall not profane it anymore, and the nation shall know he's the Lord. He's going to put the world on official notice that he's the holy covenant-keeping God, the one true God of the Bible. And that's the event he chose to do. I talk about why did he choose that event in the book? Why didn't he choose the rapture? Why did he choose the end times? Why did he need such a big event? Why did he choose Israel, not the church? I cover those topics and explain to the reader why he chose that. It was strategic. And the timing is strategic also. I mean, why is he going to do it in the end times, and what part of the end times is he going to do it? Is he going to do it after the Antichrist has emerged on the scene, and in Revelation 13, him and the false prophet implemented the Mark of the Beast campaign, which we're told in the book of Revelation, once someone takes that mark, they will be tormented with God's wrath, and often taught that they have no chance at salvation once they've done that. They've forfeited their chance at salvation. Is he going to do it after that, which we would say would be the second half of the final tribulation period? And I say, no, he's going to do it well in advance of that, because he's not going to slap his forehead and say, oy vey, I wish it's too late now. He's going to let people know in advance that Jesus is the Messiah, and that the Heavenly Father is the God who made his covenants with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's going to keep his covenants with the Jewish people. He's going to keep his promises to the believers. And we have this all integrated into this major event of Ezekiel 38 and 39. And your readers will find it interesting as to why it's not the rapture, and why he's doing it now, and why does he even have to do it? Why? I mean, he's God. He never, you know, his whole name never was unholy. He never did anything to degrade it. But why does he have to do that? Why does he let the world have to know that he's God? And I cover that all in the book. And just in a nutshell, it's been profaned, his holy name. It has been mostly forgotten. And the devastating thing with all of that is that it's the name above all names, through which no other name can anyone be saved. He's got to elevate it back to the pedestal it's supposed to be because of what's happened throughout time. The international community is running around thinking it's got impunity from any of God's will or God's foreign policy, because they've ignored him ever since the Jews were kicked out of the nation of Israel in 70 AD. But now Israel's back, and God's got plans, and he's going to put the world on notice that he's God, and you're going to have to make a decision. And that's just amazing news to me. But the question is, that's not quite ready to happen. You talk about the Armenian-Russian connection and these sorts of things, and Togarma. These are just other indicators that we are getting really close to the Gog and Magog invasion in Ezekiel 38, really close to God letting the world know he's the one true God of the Bible. So therefore, we're close for that, but it's not yet. It's a next event, a next prophecy. Then what are the now prophecies that we need to be focused on even before? So if, for instance, when you see the Christmas decorations going up at the malls, you know that Thanksgiving's about to happen, you know? So in other words, if we see Christmas is coming, we need to start thinking about Thanksgiving. And I'm putting this in the perspective of comparing it. If we see Ezekiel 38 coming and the Lord's going to put the world on notice, we need to start thinking about what are these events that are going to precede it, because that big event's just around the corner. And that's the now prophecies that I'm writing about.
Again, we've talked about the Psalm 83 conflict, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes if people want to go back and review the discussions that we've had about your book covering the Psalm 83 war. But let's talk about the destruction of Damascus. You devote a chapter to that in the book. And again, with the civil war taking place in Syria, the ceasefire that not much really ceased since that was declared on Saturday. Of course, the ceasefire excluded the two main belligerents, the Nusra Front and the Islamic State, of course. How do you see the destruction of Damascus coming about? Is this something that is going to happen outside of any interference from God's people? Or is this something that God is once again going to use either the church or Israel to accomplish?
Right. Well, inside of the book, I actually parallel passages between Jeremiah 49 verses 23 through 27 and Isaiah chapter 17 in its entirety. We get different camera angles from Jeremiah and Isaiah as to the details of the destruction of Damascus. And a lot of people are looking at the devastation in Damascus right now, and they're saying, well, this is already finding fulfillment. One brick upon another is coming down. And I caution people to – I call that newspaper exegesis. You know, you see certain events,
right,
and you try to marry them up with the scriptures to see if it's finding a fulfillment. And in the process of doing that, you often take the whole prophecy out of its context. What we have to look at is we're told who – destroys Damascus. First of all, verse 1 says, the burden against Damascus, Isaiah 17, verse 1, Damascus will cease to be a city. It will be a ruinous heap. And in the Hebrew, it means it'll be literally reduced to rubble. And, you know, all this continuously inhabited city in recorded history back to the time of Abraham, capital of Syria, in shambles now. But we're told in verse 9 that the desolation is caused by the children of Israel, the Israeli defense
yes,
forces.
Yes.
See, so we want to look – it's not by ISIS. It's not by the Jabhat al-Nusra. So we go to the scriptures, and the scriptures are pretty clear on that. I've yet to find any argument against my take on that's what that says. There's desolation because of the children of Israel. It's really quite clear. And then it says in verse 14 that it happens overnight, which makes it all the more now prophecy because Israel has the ability to take out a city overnight, and the city most strategic on Israel's list to take out is Damascus, because there's been, you know, Syria, Damascus being the capital of Syria, Syria is still at war with Israel. They never signed peace treaties with Israel like Egypt did in 1979 and Jordan did in 1994. And Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, has said, look, if you invade my country, I will take out or I'll attack Tel Aviv. He said that on numerous times several years back. Of course, Israel has attacked Syria on numerous occasions because they're trying to prevent Hezbollah from becoming more armed and more dangerous. And Hezbollah is involved now in the Syrian revolution. But Bashar al-Assad has not turned toward Israel yet or attacked Israel. Now, things are shifting for Bashar al-Assad with Russia's involvement. Their footprint in there is making a difference in favor of Bashar al-Assad, who's a proxy of Iran, who's Hezbollah's in, you know, caught up with them as well. So you got this whole geopolitical conflagration there to be concerned about. But if Bashar, what Israel's response was, is if you attack us, if you hit Tel Aviv, we will take out Damascus. I mean, this is modern day history. These quotes have come out over the last few years, and the attacking's going on. Israel is hitting Syria. So if what, the moment Bashar al-Assad says that's enough, if he feels confident in doing that, then you could have this prophecy be fulfilled. And so therefore your listeners could wake up one morning and Damascus could cease to exist because it says it happens overnight.
Yeah. And just to add some support to that, there was a report by Debka File, which is a news site based out of Tel Aviv that claims connections in the intelligence community that said that the ceasefire, the one consequence of the ceasefire was that it did give Iran and Hezbollah some breathing space, and they have been training Palestinian terrorists, according to Debka File, in refugee camps in Lebanon and also in the West Bank, and they moved several hundred of them to positions just across from the Israeli lines on the Golan Heights. So, again, things moving into position that make things more plausible than they were even a couple of weeks ago, when you could say there's nothing that Assad could do even if he wanted to because he's so busy just trying to hang on for dear life. Another aspect of the book that I want to address before we run out of time here, and this concerns what has probably been the most stable Arab country in the region for decades now, and that is Jordan. You devote a chapter to the trembling and topping of Jordan. How do you see that coming about?
Well, Zephaniah 2 and Jeremiah 49 are a few places. There's some other verses also that I cover inside of the book that talk about a time. In Jeremiah 49, it talks about a time when there'll be an alarm of war in Rabbah of the Ammonites, which would be pretty much Amman, Jordan, the capital of Jordan today. And it says that it will be a desolate mound. Now, I don't know if your listeners are familiar with the distance, maybe from San Diego to Los Angeles. It's a 2 to 3 hour drive here on the West Coast. You know, Damascus to Amman, Jordan is not a whole lot further apart. I think it's actually even closer. Damascus is going to someday cease to exist. It's going to be a ruinous heap. And it says in Jordan is going to be a desolate mound. So in other words, it almost sounds like the same kind of situation. And it says that Israel will take possession of its inheritance. So it tells us that wherever this alarm of war is that destroys and makes Amman a desolate mound, it's more than likely Israel's responsible for it, because you know, Israel's not going to move in if someone else has conquered it and say, yeah, we'll take it now. Thanks for doing our dirty work for us. We'll go move in. No, it's the Israeli defense forces that are going to do that. And Jordan is in the Psalm 83 Confederacy. And it says what's interesting, it's a prophecy that's relevant right now, never happened in Jordan's history before, hasn't been taught by, I would say probably by any prophecy teacher, and that's in Jeremiah 49, verse 5. It says that fear is going to surround Jordan from all sides, and ultimately the Jordanians will be driven out headlong, and no one will gather them back. And it's ultimately, it says, the good news is there will be a remnant of Jordanians who actually the Lord will bring back, who come to know Jesus as the Messiah in the end of time, you know, which at the end of the tribulation, mm-hmm. that group that gets driven out headlong. And if you look at what's going on around Jordan right now, every side of it has got it trembling. And King Abdullah II has come over to Washington on three different occasions over the last year and a half and met with Barack Obama because he's concerned about what's going on. He can't deal with the refugee crisis around him. It's swallowing up his country. There's tons of people trying to get in. They're prime candidates for ISIS recruiting. He's got ISIS sympathizers within the Palestinian population, which is about 60% of his countrymen, that are Sunni. They're looking at what happened in Syria and Jordan with ISIS, and they're saying, we want that here. I mean, King Abdullah II is probably going to be the next Jordanian leader to go. And I mean, Arab leader, not Jordanian leader, Arab leader to go in this aftermath of this Arab Spring and the deposing of all these different Arab leaders. This is a big deal. And it all boils down to when God's about to uphold his holy name in Ezekiel 38, all the other prophecies are going to line up and get done so that event can happen. And that's going to trump everything else, speaking of Trump. That God upholding his holy name is going to trump everything else. And so I would just say, as we kind of close out today, Derek, is that I believe the reason that these prophecies have not happened yet, the ones that really lack conditions at this point, that could happen at any given time, is because of God's long suffering and mercy. And he is doing supernatural evangelism in these downtrodden, repressed areas where missionaries can hardly get into, like Iran and Syrian refugee camps and stuff like that. You're hearing about dreams and visions and miracles and healings, and I write about them in the book. God is going ahead of these prophecies. He is doing what he wants to do, which is accomplish the will of his heart, that none would perish. He is bringing people into the kingdom. These people that are having these dreams and visions and healings are converting from Islam into Christianity. He is doing all this stuff. But the point is going to come where these prophecies will roll off of the parchment, and they will hit the pavement, and they will be powerful punches delivered to Damascus and Amman, Jordan, and Iran. And Americans need to be careful. We tend to think, especially American Christians, that God's up in heaven humming the Star-Spangled Banner draped in the American flag. We've ignored the fact that we've said goodbye to him over the last 5 to 6 decades, and we think that those Middle East prophecies are going to confine themselves to the Middle East, right, and we're going to be okay as long as it just stays over there. That is not what Bible prophecies are about. Bible prophecies are globally impacting. So they need the American Christians and the American people need to get ready for the events that are about to unfold. And that's what I'm trying to do with this Now Prophecies book. Prepare them and explain these prophecies to them so they can know how to best buckle up for the stuff that's coming.
And preparation is important. You raised a good point earlier, and this reminded me of a story, well, an incident, conversation, that's the best word, for that I had with a gentleman I became friends with when I was working in outside sales a couple of years ago. Central Illinois, fellow's a buyer for a company that fabricates big metal things. And he and a good friend of his, really interested in prophecy. He's a regular listener to radio programs that deal in prophecy, watches prophecy in the news, prophecy watchers, Skywatch TV, now, because we came here. But he was concerned about how things are going to affect his grandchildren. And he looks in the Bible and he sees all of these things, wars, rumors of wars, pestilence and earthquakes in diverse places and things like that. And it really disturbs him because he loves his grandchildren. He doesn't want them to go through a period of tribulation and suffering. What's the good news in the preparation, Bill? How do we process this and then pass along good news and comfort to our children and our grandchildren?
Well, the good news is you can have a relationship with Jesus Christ right now. I mean, let's just get right to the main important thing right now is that they can, if they don't know Jesus Christ, or if they've strayed from Jesus Christ, or they want to be under the protection of Jesus Christ, that is all wrapped up in the fact that they just need to accept Him as their Savior, or be, purify their hearts if they've already accepted them as their Savior and redeem the time, because all this is pointing to a soon return. Mm-hmm. One of the now prophecies is Jesus is going to come to get His bride. He's been waiting for 2,000 years to fetch His bride in the rapture event. I write about this in the book. And when the Heavenly Father says to His only begotten Son, Jesus Christ, go get your bride, son, He's going to get them in the twinkling of an eye, which means that not even a split second will be able to stand between His love for those who believe in Him and Him. And He's been up in John 14 preparing mansions for them in heaven, mm-hmm. places that He's prepared for them in advance that He's about to take them to. That is about to happen. So we need to redeem the time. But the blessing that the younger generation has, because I'm concerned about the same thing with my grandkids, you know, really these prophecies are going to affect them. They'll probably affect us. Mm-hmm. But they're definitely going to affect them. I just don't see them being postponed much longer. That's why we need to be prepared now at the present time, even though the prophecies may tarry a little bit. We can't take that chance. The blessing for the younger generation and us right now is that God gave this generation more information about prophetic information than any other generation in all time, because He knew we would need that information to get ready and prepare. That's out of His love. He didn't issue these prophecies 2,000-3,000 years ago, because when the event was going to happen, he needed to, you know, he has a bad memory and he was going to, you know, need notes to review. He gave it to us because when the events happen, we would be able to take this information and witness with it and steward our lives with it and prepare for it and grow from it. And that's where we're at right now. And with Israel becoming a nation now, we really don't have any more excuses to seal this stuff up or just simply talk about it. We need to get prepared for it. These prophecies were meant for us to understand and get ready for.
Hmm. Bill Salas is the author of the new book, The Prophecy, or The Now Prophecies, rather. His website, prophecydepotministries.net. And there'll be links to where you can find the book and to his website in the show notes at vftb.net. And, of course, Bill, one of the featured speakers at the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference coming up in July. And I'll tell you more about that in just a couple of minutes. That, by the way, sold out now, but there will be live streaming, and I'll have details for you in just a couple of minutes. Bill, thanks again for your time today. And if not sooner, if we can't get you out here to the Ozarks, look forward to seeing you in Colorado Springs.
Absolutely, Derek. Thanks again for having me on your program.
The show notes are posted at vftb.net, and you'll find a link there to the website of Bill Salas, prophecydepotministries.com. And from there, links, of course, to the book, The Now Prophecies, also a DVD teaching. So you get it in written form or just watching Bill explain it. And, of course, you'll get an opportunity to do that at the International Prophecy, Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference this summer, as Bill will be one of the featured speakers there. We are honored to be a part of that again this year and looking forward to it. And I think this year I got something a little different. I've been kind of focusing my presentations in recent years on Dominion theology, which is an important thing, and also the rise of the transhumanist movement, which, of course, is the feature of the movie Inhuman, The Next and Final Phase of Man is Here. But I've got something else I'm working on, so we shall see if that comes to fruition, something a little more along the line. Trying to visualize a scenario in how various prophecies of different religious groups may come together to create a great deception. Not original thought to me. Actually, this is inspired by the work of Chris White and his book, False Christ. But hopefully we'll take this and maybe add a little bit to it and make it worth your while. By the way, the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference is sold out now. So registrations are closed, at least for the time being. There generally are some cancellations between now and July. So if you're thinking that maybe you would have liked to have gone and just didn't do it early enough, that might yet be possible. So we'll let you know if that changes. But live streaming is available again this year. And this year, instead of just live streaming the main room, there will be two rooms from which presentations will be streamed. The main ballroom, of course, And then the Aspen Room, which is one of the larger breakout rooms at the Marriott in Colorado Springs. You can purchase a package to see just the main ballroom or just the Aspen Room. And if you're thinking about that, you may want to wait until the schedules are posted. It's $50 to do just the Aspen Room or just the main ballroom. But if you want to do both, it's $79.95. So you can save $20 by doing both. And the videos, the presentations, will be archived on the server for you to access for 6 weeks, not just 4 weeks, as been the case the last couple of years. 6 weeks this time. So another option and an opportunity this way to see more of the speakers, even if you cannot be in Colorado Springs July 15th through the 17th. So, again, we'll keep you posted on how things develop as far as the availability of registrations. In just a few minutes, a couple of things I want to touch on here that will be featured during this week of daily updates on SkyWatch TV. Also, by the way, a couple of special presentations this week during the daily updates on SkyWatch TV. Richard Shaw, L.A. Marzulli's business partner on the Watchers series of DVDs, and the producer and director of the film Torah Codes, End to Darkness, was in here in the Ozarks last week, and so we recorded a couple of updates about things that he's hearing from the rabbis researching the Torah Codes, and you'll see those on Monday and Tuesday. But there's some interesting things in the news I want to touch on just to because of my psychological need to express my opinion. Elites in the Republican Party are just freaking out about Donald Trump and the fact that his campaign has not imploded, in spite of some of the things that Trump has said. And I've said publicly before, I will repeat, I probably wouldn't enjoy spending much time in Trump's presence, but boy, it's fun watching him kick the GOP in the pants. And I think that's the sentiment of a lot of Republican voters this time around, because we've been promised every election, every 4 years since about 1992, when George Bush Sr. ran against Bill Clinton, that we Republicans needed to go to the polls to save America from the evil that the Democrats would do if they got control of the White House. We saw it, heard it in 92. We especially heard it in 96 after the first term of Bill Clinton. We heard it in 04, well, in 2000 again, when Bush ran against Gore, and then again in 04 when we can't change horses in the middle of the war on terror. When Barack Obama came up in 08, it's, you know, we needed to save the country from this inexperienced rookie. Every 4 years, we hear the same message. We need to save America from the Democrats. And dutifully, conservative Christians typically who vote, typically vote Republican, go to the polls and cast their votes overwhelmingly for the Republican candidate. And what has it given us? The largest increase in discretionary spending of the federal budget since Franklin Roosevelt. We got Supreme Court Justice John Roberts, appointed by George W. Bush, who cast the deciding vote in favor of Obamacare. We got nation-building attempts in Afghanistan and Iraq that are still ongoing 15 years down the road. Attempts that are draining the American treasury, not to mention the lifeblood of many American young men and women. And Donald Trump comes along and he finally addressed the elephant in the room that Republicans out here in the in flyover land have known since 2003, 2005, that this was a waste of money, a waste of lives, not just American lives, but Afghan lives, Iraqi lives, now Syrian lives. It was a waste. And Trump said it. The American people, Republican voters, responded to it, even though the conservative, in air quotes, media, like Fox News, recoiled in horror. How dare he suggest that the wars started by George W. Bush were anything but righteous? The American people, you know, we've been living this with for 15 years now. And Trump said what a lot of us out here are thinking, and that's why Trump is still leading in the polls in the Republican race. Now, I know a lot of Christians don't like Donald Trump, and I understand why. I mean, he's runs casinos. At least one of his casinos has a strip club in it. He's a man who very publicly shamed his first wife with a public affair. The woman he's married to now is posed in very skimpy clothing in pictures that didn't take much effort to find on the internet. So, yeah, as a person, would I like Donald Trump? Probably not. But he is addressing one topic that the other candidates just aren't addressing. Well, one main topic, and that is whether we are going to remain a nation, or are we going to subsume our sovereignty into a new globalist world order, which is what the Republican elites apparently want. My opinion, I haven't yet reached a point where I've decided who I'm going to vote for. I understand why a lot of conservative Christians are supporting Ted Cruz and would like to see him win. I understand why many supported Dr. Ben Carson before he dropped out of the race. But being a good Christian doesn't necessarily mean you're qualified to be president of the United States. Sometimes the best man for a particular job is a real jerk. So we'll see how this goes, but it is fun watching Republican elites writhe in agony as they see Trump continuing to rack up delegates as we move toward the Republican National Convention. And just remember, Christians, that 10 years ago, an official in President Bush's Office of Faith-Based Initiatives wrote a book in which he revealed that the advisors to President Bush inside the White House ridiculed evangelical Christians, supporters of President Bush, as nuts and goofy, but easily manipulated. They used us. And I think there is a sense among Republican voters that that is exactly the case. And that's why they've been responding to a brash, possibly megalomaniacal man like Donald Trump, because he is publicly running counter to what the conservative elites want. And conservative, when you're referring to the head of the Republican Party, is in name only, because they are selling out our national sovereignty, and they are not conservative in the sense of being fiscally responsible or focusing first on the needs of the American citizen, as opposed to using our military and the blood of our young men and women to build and maintain an empire overseas, because that's exactly what's going on. So Republican elites are trying to figure out how to defeat Donald Trump. And this is what is really amusing to me. Party insiders who oppose Donald Trump are trying to figure out how to beat him at the convention. The problem is that according to rules that were adopted in 2012, the only candidates who can even make it to the nominating ballot are those who've won a majority of votes, a majority of delegates, rather, from 8 states. Trump right now is the only one who qualifies. Ted Cruz has won 4. Rubio has won 1. Kasich has 0. So as of now, Trump is the only one who could even make it onto the nominating ballot. Now, there are more state primaries ahead, so that may change. But in order to get more candidates on the bill, and you know, you need to be aware that Trump and Cruz together are both running as outsiders, because Republican elites don't like Ted Cruz any more than they like Donald Trump. And between the two of them, Trump and Cruz are pulling about 2/3 of the votes in the Republican primaries. The elites want to see Marco Rubio or John Kasich, anybody except Trump or Cruz. So I think ideally, I would love to see Trump and Cruz, you know, declare a truce and take over the party. Now, there are some who've expressed the opinion that this is all a scam, that Trump is conning us, and maybe he is. But it sure makes for good theater. But the funny thing about this rule, the 8-state rule, is that it was put in place in 2012 to prevent Ron Paul from getting on the nominating ballot. Ron Paul's supporters were so effective at the caucus states and would have been so effective, and they were well organized at the convention, they could have forced him onto the ballot, and who knows what would have happened. So to keep Ron Paul off the ballot, they put in place a rule that is now apparently going to keep the establishment candidates, Rubio and Kasich, from getting on the ballot. So if they try to change the rules at the convention, it'll be pretty obvious what they're trying to do. And I think they may fracture the party. I think if those of us out here in flyover land have any sense at all, if they try that tactic to deny the nomination to Trump or Cruz, those of us out here just ought to say, the heck with it. We're not, you know, you don't own us anymore. You don't own us, and we're not going to keep going your way. I did write a piece this week based, and it's posted to skywatchtv.com, also at my website, derekpgilbert.com, about an interesting comment that Newt Gingrich, former Speaker of the House, made on Fox News this week. And I will quote, in describing or trying to explain the opposition to Donald Trump of the Republican elites, quoting, and now they're faced with a very real prospect of Donald Trump becoming the leader of the party, and it absolutely drives them crazy. They just cannot imagine sharing. Then the host asks why, and Gingrich continues, because he's an outsider. He's not them. He's not part of the club. He's uncontrollable. He hasn't been through the initiation rites. He doesn't belong to the secret society. And that may just have been a jab at the Ivy League cabal that controls the Republican Party at the top level, or Gingrich, who was in a position to know, may actually mean that's because Trump wasn't from the right family. His grandfather was a German immigrant who made his money by running a hotel during the Yukon Gold Rush that catered to the physical needs of the miners in more ways than one, if you know what I mean. So, you know, he's relatively new money. He didn't go to Yale. He's brash. He speaks off the cuff. He's a street fighter. He's not one of them. He didn't go through the initiation rites. Gingrich may literally mean it's because he's not in the right secret society. And interestingly, it's come out in the last week or so since the passing of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia that when he died at that resort ranch in Houston, he was in the company of a couple of high-ranking members of a group called the International Order of St. Hubertus. The International Order of St. Hubertus. This is a knightly order that was founded in 1695 by a member of the Royal Habsburg dynasty, Count Franz Anton von Spork, which was then, he was then of the Kingdom of Bohemia, now part of the Czech Republic. The current Grand Master is also a Habsburg. He is the Archduke of Austria, which is interesting, as the first time an Archduke of Austria has made news in about 100 years. Sorry, that was in poor taste. István von Habsburg-Lothringen, Archduke of Austria and Prince of Hungary, is the current Grand Master, and the order is under the royal protection of King Juan Carlos of Spain, which is also interesting. But another detail that the Washington Post published this week is that the American Order, the American branch of the International Order of St. Hubertus, was founded at the Bohemian Club in San Francisco in 1966. And yes, this is the group that sponsors the annual retreat for the elites at the Bohemian Grove in Sonoma County, California, and all that that implies. So what was the connection of Justice Scalia to the International Order of St. Hubertus? We don't know. That's not clear. But again, two of the men there, including the gentleman who traveled to Texas with Justice Scalia, officers in the American chapter of the International Order of St. Hubertus. So, the actual reason the elites oppose Trump could be that he's a loose cannon, a renegade, and they genuinely believe he's bad for the party. Or, on the other hand, as implied by Newt Gingrich, it could be that he is just not a member of the right secret society. Overseas, a story that is developing into a real disaster. The nations to the north of Greece have closed their borders to the refugees that are flooding into the nation from Turkey and other points in the Middle East. Austria, several days ago, closed its borders, and so nine other nations in the Balkans closed their borders to the south, which means there are 50,000 to 70,000 people stranded in Greece. They can't go north, and they can't go home, and Greece can't feed them. Comes news a couple of days ago that migrants in Greece are to be handed cash in envelopes to, quote, maintain their dignity, end quote. This is a $550 million cash transfer from the European Union's Disaster Relief Fund. I'm trying to get a quick sense on how much money that's worth in U.S. dollars. £550 million in the disaster fund there. That's roughly equivalent to $782 million U.S. dollars. It's difficult. At least we're getting into springtime, and it isn't winter there, which would make things really bad. But still, you've got a lot of people who aren't housed. There's no infrastructure for them. And Greece has been teetering on the edge of financial collapse now for a couple of years. The EU forcing some pretty stringent budget changes on Greece in order to bail them out. The EU money supposedly to be used to buy medicines, blankets, and food, but if they're handing it to these people in the form of envelopes, it's just cash in envelopes, where is that money going to go? I mean, are they going to use it to pay human traffickers to get them into Europe around the closed borders? Or will it be used as intended, to buy medicine, food, clothing, blankets, etc.? That question sounds harsh, but remember after Hurricane Katrina, when FEMA here in the United States, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, handed out debit cards, $2,000 debit cards, to refugees from Hurricane Katrina, people who fled New Orleans for points west and north. And within a couple of days, FEMA had to stop the debit card program because of abuse. The General Accounting Office of the U.S. noted in rather dry bureaucratic language, quote, debit cards were used for items or services such as a Caribbean vacation, professional football tickets, and adult entertainment, which do not appear to be necessary to satisfy disaster-related needs as defined by FEMA regulations, end quote. That's putting it mildly. Table 2, purchases that did not appear, with tables and graphs, purchases that did not appear necessary to satisfy immediate emergency needs. $1,300 spent in Jefferson, Louisiana, Elliott's Gun Shop for a .45 caliber pistol. Vendor, D. Houston, Houston, Texas. Gentleman's Club, $1,200 spent at the Gentleman's Club. $1,100 in Plano, Texas for a diamond engagement ring. $1,000 at the Argosy Casino in Baton Rouge. 7 ATM withdrawals within a day at a gambling institution. $1,000 spent on a bail bond payment. $400 spent in a massage parlor. $450 spent to buy a tattoo. On and on. So there were a number of other examples in the tables from that GAO report, which was published by The Atlantic in 2012, 7 years down the road, as they wrote an article addressing whether it was just an urban legend that Katrina victims spent their relief money on Louis Vuitton bags and massage parlors. And the fact is, yes, some people did. Diamond jewelry, one-week Caribbean vacation, 5 New Orleans Saints football season tickets, divorce lawyer services. All of that money that was handed out to refugees from Hurricane Katrina, human nature being as it is, I suspect we'll see some of those same abuses when cash is handed to refugees in Greece. It is an ugly, ugly situation. Next week on A View from the Bunker, as we've gone back to a once-a-week schedule, you'll hear Troy Anderson, co-author of the book The Babylon Code. Paul McGuire is co-author. We've talked to them both on Skywatch TV, but have not had Troy Anderson on this program. Paul McGuire's been a guest several times. We discuss what is the Babylon Code, why is Babylon still influencing our world today, how does it impact on future prophecy? That is March 13th on A View from the Bunker. Our weekly Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship, posted two new studies today, New Testament and Old Testament, as we go through those sections of the Bible in chronological order. Wonderful psalm from David today, Psalm 19, about the majesty of the stars in heaven, reflecting the work of his hands. magnificent. So you'll find those posted each week, available for download at gilberthouse.org. This Tuesday night on Skywatch TV, a very touching episode where Nita Horn is featured. She talks about the new memoir coming out in about a month from Defender Publishing called No Fences. You'll hear Nita tell her story, the setbacks that she has endured in her life, some of which were, frankly, traumatic, and how the Lord sometimes uses those to prepare us for where he wants us to go. That's, well, I said this Tuesday night. Actually, Skywatch TV now airing multiple times per week, Monday on the Victory Television Network, twice on Tuesday on Victory and on the Christian Television Network, Wednesday afternoon on the Cornerstone Network, and then on next Saturday, that would be the 12th, the Cornerstone Network, or rather the Victory Television Network and the Cornerstone Christian Television Network. All of that posted, by the way, the dates and times at skywatchtv.com. Look in the top menu bar there where it says channel listing, and you'll see when and where you can watch Skywatch TV, as we are now multiple times per week and beginning the week of the 13th, beginning next week Sunday. On Tuesdays, we go to like four different places in the same day. So I'm not going to be able to repeat all of that anymore. So I'm just going to tell you who the guest is for the week. And this week, Nita Horn talking about her new memoir, No Fences. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert. This is A View from the Bunker.